Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior is home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature stories and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the One River, Many Stories project. This year, 8 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems about the St. Louis River. We now bring you their stories as told before a live audience on Wednesday, April 27th at UW Superior. Wisconsin Public Radio presents One River, Many Stories.
Good evening. My name is Jennifer Moore, and I'd like to welcome you all to Wisconsin Public Radio's One River, Many Stories event. I'm an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and I'll be your MC for this evening's readings. Readings of stories and poems written by people living in and around the Twin Ports. As a member of the One River, Many Stories team, I'd like to thank WPR for putting on this event and thank the University of Wisconsin-Superior for providing us with a venue to share these stories with the public. We must also thank our writers and the judges who selected submissions you are about to hear. Without them, this event would not be possible. But before we get started, I want to give you a little bit of the backstory. The late Wisconsin Public Radio reporter, Mike Simonson, inspired tonight's readings and other events happening this month as a part of the One River, Many Stories project. One River, Many Stories began when Perfect Duluth Day President Paul Lundgren suggested honoring Mike's memory and his legacy of journalism in northern Wisconsin by telling stories about the St. Louis River, its communities, and its people. Lundgren partnered with University of Minnesota Duluth journalism professor John Hatcher and others to fund a project inviting media outlets across the Twin Ports to feature stories over the course of 1 month about the river. The Knight Foundation Fund of the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation provided funding to support this event and others through this media collaboration project. So, why the St. Louis River, you may ask? As Paul tells it, Mike shared plans for his retirement in their last conversation together. Those plans included writing a radio documentary about the St. Louis River. Unfortunately, Mike died a short time after, in October of 2014. Many of Mike's students and colleagues continue his legacy through their tireless dedication to tell stories about the people and places of this region. And Mike's widow, Jennifer Simonson, can tell you about how much he loved the river. They often invited friends to take boat rides with them on the Stryker Bay near their home in West Duluth. So tonight, we invite you to sit back and listen to the stories and poems from those who have been willing to share their thoughts, feelings, and experiences about the St. Louis River. So, without further ado, Wisconsin Public Radio presents One River, Many Stories. Our first reader this evening is Sheila Pekka.
Hello. Whatever you write about makes it stronger. That's why I'm so glad that everyone's writing about the St. Louis River. I paddled the canoe along the river that unraveled like a yarn through the forest. I held the arms of wind-fallen trees and pulled the boat through the shallows. I walked on the bottom of the river in its light. I went over the path of the French explorer who named the river after Louis XIV, over the trail of the Wanigans, the floating bunkhouses and cook shacks when there were log drives. I paddled past immigrants, my Finnish grandparents and Zim, past beaver traps and hoop nets, wood ducks and mallards, over the catfish, walleyes, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. I paddled past moose and bear and timber wolves, past white-tailed deer and ruffed grouse, under the pines. I was going nowhere in particular, was going to stop, was staying afloat, getting here.
Hi, I'm Jan Cronister. I live in Maple, Wisconsin. And this poem is called Estuary. Morning condensation on the window is the shape of Lake Superior. Wolf snout, arched back, island eye. Body of water between us and Canada. Summer cooler, winter curse. When it rains, river mouths bleed from ancient clay beds laid before mining and weekend campers came to Whiteface. Before worlds began to explode, before drought and mercury, before the moisture on my window runs like a tear to the sea.
Hi, I'm Mark Munger, and I'm going to be reading a prose piece. I want to say two things. First of all, I live on the Cloquet River, which is the major tributary to the St. Louis River, about 20 miles north of Duluth, so the river is dear to me. Secondly, I went to Duluth Denfeld and graduated with Mike's older brother, Mark, and Mike Simonson graduated with my wife from Denfeld, so it's a pretty special honor to be able to read my piece here tonight. In Mike's honor, in honor of the river that he loved. My piece is entitled Ducks. The river spreads out beneath the Bong Bridge. A flat plain of decaying ice extends from Minnesota to the wooded Wisconsin shore, looming larger through the windshield of my wife's Rogue. I'm headed to Appleton to say goodbye to a friend. My wife sits in the Nissan's front passenger seat. Warren Zevon playing in the background, rubber humming against concrete. I think about my friend Pat. We met at Denfeld High School playing B-team football. As the engine purrs, I muse that as long as I've known Pat, I've known Vicky, Pat's wife, even longer. Vicky and I grew up a few blocks apart in Piedmont Heights, a post-war suburban neighborhood that sits high above Duluth, affording expansive views of the meandering St. Louis River, and its ultimate destination, the seemingly inexhaustible Big Lake. Unlike me, Pat lived his formative years in West Duluth, and given that he grew up within a stone's throw of the river and the fat, grain-fed, green-headed mallards that claimed the marshes and ponds of St. Louis as their home, you'd have thought Pat knew something about duck hunting, but he didn't. Autumn of my freshman year at UMD, my buddy Rick, who grew up a few doors down from Pat, figured out that the sloughs and marshes behind the Elliott Meat Processing Plant in the shadow of the Titanic DM&IR ore docks on the Duluth side of the river were favored by mallards gathering for migration. Now, understand, duck hunting on the Superior side of the St. Louis River, provided one stays a safe distance from businesses and dwellings, provided one possesses a Wisconsin license and a duck stamp, was and is perfectly legal. Trouble was, Rick and I were college kids, working minimum wage jobs. We weren't about to buy a Wisconsin non-resident license and duck stamp on the off chance we might shoot a mallard or two. No, in the time-honored tradition of my dad and his West Duluth buddies, we were destined to hunt the Minnesota side of the river, which caused us to run afoul of the law. Oh, Rick and I weren't stupid. We bought Minnesota licenses and duck stamps, making us eligible to duck hunt in Minnesota. But there was, and still is, a pesky Duluth City ordinance that prohibits the discharge of a firearm within the city of Duluth. So while Rick and I could legally hunt ducks in Minnesota, we couldn't legally hunt ducks in Duluth, Minnesota. The Washburn House was the home of Mr. and Mrs. Washburn and their six kids. Rick was the oldest. Most days when Rick and I were going to hunt, Mrs. Washburn would make us a hot breakfast, and the three of us, Rick's mom, Rick, and I, would sit at an enormous pine table in the narrow kitchen, eating, talking, sipping hot coffee as a blanket of darkness cloaked the slumbering neighborhood. Rick's mom never asked us where we were going to hunt, though if she'd asked, we'd have told her behind Elliott's. She would have accepted our answer despite the illegitimacy of the reply. Being the mother of five sons and a daughter, Mrs. Washburn wasn't the sort of woman to get excited about one of her kids violating a seldom enforced city ordinance. There were bigger things in her estimation, such as how to keep five boys in hockey skates on a railroad or salary to worry about, than whether some overzealous Duluth cop was going to ticket her oldest kid for duck hunting in the city. Besides, tradition held that so long as no one complained, the cops would look the other way. Mrs. Washburn understood this, so did we. You're impatiently asking, yeah, but what does this have to do with Pat? I'm getting to that. Rick and I fortified ourselves with Mrs. Washburn's breakfast before setting up Meller decoys in shallow water. Behind the old meatpacking plant, next to the ore docks, a point interrupts the St. Louis River on its methodical descent to Lake Superior. Sometimes, as we set up to hunt, employees on the ore docks would ask, how's it going? Other than that, no one bothered us. No one questioned our right to hunt the Minnesota side of the river. It just wasn't that big a deal. Hiding in bulrushes, decoys bobbing on riffles, we'd shoot mallards or teal or woodies, drawn to the floating ruse, watch my brother's golden retriever bring in the ducks, reclaim our decoys, tromp back to the gravel parking lot, pack up my Wagoneer, drop off dead ducks for Rick's mother to clean, all before heading off to class. Rick would leave a shotgun at his house. I'd leave my Winchester in my Jeep, parked in the UMD lot. A different time, a different world. One night, while playing poker at Pat's, the topic of duck hunting came up. I'm going tomorrow with Washburn, I said. I'd hunted grouse with Pat and knew he wasn't much of a shot. But he seemed so hell-bent for leather on joining us, I couldn't say no. 4:30 the next morning, Pat joined Rick and me for breakfast in the Washburn kitchen. Out on the point, November wind whipped St. Louis Bay to a frenzy. I plodded through cold, bronze-colored water in hip waders, anchoring decoys to the river's muddy bottom. You stay in the blind, I told Pat when I returned to shore. My friend was hunkered down behind a tangle of cattails, out of the wind and concealed. Rick and I'll walk each side of the point. Hopefully we'll jump a few mallards holding tight in the wind. They'll swing towards you. Stay low. Pop up. Shoot as they land. The dog will do the rest. I got it. I left Pat, his breath curling above the fuzzy-headed cattails, barrel of his 16-gauge pump reflecting the newly risen sun, and started to tromp through surrounding marsh in hopes of raising birds. A few coots scattered in the distance. A pair of wood ducks, the male resplendent in color, rose out of range, caught the wind, and scuttled towards Wisconsin. I kept going. On the other side of the point, Rick's semi-auto 12-gauge barked. I tromped on. My noisy passage through cane startled a great blue heron feeding in a pond. The big bird took flight, looking more like a prehistoric dinosaur than a bird, its long wings slowly lifting its slight body off fetid water. Sunlight caught the narrow head of the great bird as it turned towards the point. Uh-oh. Pat's 16-gauge barked once, twice, three times. I moved as quickly as my hip waders would allow. When I made the blind, Pat was standing, gun at parade rest, admiring the slow, methodical retreat of the great blue heron. Biggest damn goose I've ever seen, Pat said. Too bad I missed. When folks tell stories about Pat at the Episcopal Chapel in Appleton at his eulogy, I too will have something to say about my friend. But the story of the one that got away is not a story I intend to tell in church. Thank you.
Ashley Sullivan, and I am from Duluth, Minnesota. I will be reading you a poem tonight. It's short but sweet, so I'm going to ask you guys to do me a favor and pick your most favorite spot on the St. Louis River, whether it be a fishing spot or a hiking spot or a sitting spot, and close your eyes while I read the poem and just kind of be there as I read. The title of my poem is Breath from This Body of Water. A bed for the beavers and ducks and geese, refreshing for the deer. A bird's eye view will get you to her deep blue soul. A playground for children. An adventure for those who seek excitement in her ever-turning moods. Root beer to the naked eye. A source of prosperity for the nature lovers, home to many who seek shelter near her. The St. Louis River is more than just a river. Her lungs churn in and out between hectic flows and calming cascades. The St. Louis River is alive. You can feel her pulse in your veins as you walk the earth beside her. She guides you on your exploration of self. She embraces you. She loves you. Evermore, breathe in her breath. Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to a special one-hour broadcast of One River, Many Stories, stories and poetry about the St. Louis River. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at the University of Wisconsin in Superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good evening, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior is home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature stories and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the One River, Many Stories project. This year, eight writers were chosen by three judges to read their stories and poems about the St. Louis River. We now bring you their stories as told before a live audience on Wednesday, April 27th at UW Superior. Wisconsin Public Radio presents One River, Many Stories.
Hello, my name is Cliff Langley. I live in Esco, Minnesota, near Jay Cook State Park and the St. Louis River. Quick few things before I read my piece. My piece is about whitewater kayaking the St. Louis River at the peak of the 2012 flood. And I just want to put out there a disclaimer that I've already been paddling for like almost 20 years before we did this, so I'm an expert paddler, and so are the other people I was with, so it's not just something that you just randomly do because you could die. Also, I mentioned CFS, which is cubic feet per second. That's a way to measure the volume of a river. So just thought I'd throw that out there. My piece is called Unleashed, the Primal Call of Gitchigami Zibi. The scene was familiar and foreign all at once. It felt like we were floating in a parallel universe. The river began to accelerate, drawing us towards a massive wave, easily 25 feet tall. The immensity of it all seemed surreal as we drifted in our kayaks towards the mammoth wave. We were experiencing the power of nature in one of its rawest forms. At that moment, the St. Louis River was unleashed, untethered, and beyond control. 48 hours before, on a late June night, over 9 inches of rain had fallen within the St. Louis River watershed. A large basin of over 3,600 square miles was completely inundated in heavy rain. The vast spruce bogs and peatlands near the headwaters were saturated beyond their capacity, and every tributary was flooding its banks. Landslides and washouts were commonplace throughout the watershed. Below the Thompson Dam, the lower St. Louis River was a raging, seething death torrent. Huge logs were tossed about the canyon walls as exploding waves rose and fell tens of feet in a moment. Water was beginning to flow over the section of the Highway 210 bridge, normally dozens of feet above the river. In Jay Cook State Park, the swinging bridge was crumpled and twisted, then washed away. It was the peak of what would be deemed the 500-year flood. The flood had reached its peak and the extent of damage had been done. We certainly did not know the cost or extent of the damages caused by the flood at that point, but risks to human life had subsided, and it seemed that the Thompson and Fond du Lac dams would hold. At this point, being experienced whitewater kayakers and having paddled the St. Louis River at flood stages in the past, we wanted to experience the river's immensity. Our past experiences wrestling big water in the St. Louis River was in the 25,000 cubic feet per second range. CFS, cubic feet per second, is a means to measure the volume of a river. Above 20,000 CFS, the St. Louis River is considered to be at flood stage. At these flows, the upper St. Louis River had exhibited massive waves and huge holes, certainly retentive enough to deal out a beating. You would be lucky to survive if you swam on the St. Louis River at such a flow. The flow that evening was over 55,000 CFS. Experienced big water boaters would advise it best to stay in the middle of the river at such a high flow to avoid logs and powerful and turbulent eddies. Additionally, large features like holes are likely to flush you out in the middle, in theory. So this was our plan for a 55,000 CFS run. Our party of three, Decker, Professor Z, and myself, put on the river in Scanlon, Minnesota, 4.5 miles upstream of the Thompson Dam. The typical whiskey-colored water, stained from the tannins released by decaying vegetation in the peatlands upstream, was more of a milky brown from all the sediment. Once on the river, it was less than a minute before we were doing the limbo under the I-35 bridge. We looked back at the bridge, knowing that we'd literally passed the point of no return. Now it was full commitment to flowing down the middle of the river. Paddling through the trees at such flows would be death. Big waves were sure to be down the middle, and big waves are usually fun. A moment later, the current had brought us to the canyon. The previous rapids had been washed out, and the river was flooding the forest. A massive diagonal wave, some 10 feet tall, was breaking off the left canyon wall. We charged into the massive feature, then paddled and raced away through a series of turbulent waves, many over 10 feet tall, tossing us in all directions. These would serve as our warm-up for the challenge ahead, the Electric Ledge. The Electric Ledge Rapid, at typical summer flows, is a fun Class 3 featuring a tongue of water that drops quickly into a powerful wave. The rapid is sculpted from ages of water dropping over, into, and across tilted ridges of the Thompson Formation bedrock. The steeply slanted ridges were born from compressed sediment of 2 billion-year-old seas that had been forged through millions of years of heat and pressure into the metamorphic rock known as slate. Tectonic plate movements from the north and south faulted the bedrock and pushed into and up onto itself. At 55,000 CFS, these ridges would create gigantic waves and holes. In the middle was the biggest of these waves, a gigantic wave some 25 feet tall and at least as wide. Decker was the first to ascend the steep face of the wave, then disappear over the top. Professor Z was close behind. As he neared the crest of the wave, the top third exploded violently, tossing it backwards into the air and out of sight. I climbed the wave, charging as hard and as fast as I could as the wave was about to break again. I fell off the backside of the wave into the air. The moment of free fall lasted only an instant as a huge wave hit me from the side. The surge immediately sent me 20 feet to the left. The next several hundred yards consisted of huge 10 to 15 foot waves surging and breaking in all directions. Tossing us about like bobbers, I could occasionally see Decker and Professor Z. The river accelerated into one last fluffy wave created from the river flowing over an island that usually stood a couple of dozen feet tall above the river. Past the last wave, we floated and looked at each other in astonishment. We had made an hour-long run in less than 15 minutes. Soaked and stoked, our risk had been rewarded, thanks to experience and some luck. I felt grateful for the opportunity to experience the river in its ancient form, perhaps similar to its flow some 6,000 to 7,500 years ago, as the ice dam that plugged the St. Mary's River broke, draining Glacial Lake Duluth. Glacial floods scoured the 2-billion-year-old rock as Gitchikamizibi drained into Lake Superior, further sculpting the unique rapids and landscapes we see today. As the first peoples came to these shores, had they seen the river this powerful? They had certainly seen and lived with it, untethered by dams and modern technologies, and knew intimately its power. On that June evening, we rode upon the river's primal scream, a reminder of its old age and its youth, and of our insignificance in both power and time.
I'm still Jan. When the call went out for poems and stories about the St. Louis River, I knew I had to go to the Thompson Dam because that, to me, is one of the most impressive places. It's not my favorite place on the river, but it's one of the most impressive. If you've never been there, you need to go there. And I was there on Good Friday, and it was really dangerous, I think. This poem is called At Thompson Dam on Good Friday. I am a buoy in the river, orange ball bouncing. My powerlessness gives me purpose. Hang on tight, fight the current. To someone standing on the bridge, I must look useless. My rope is tied to ancient Laurentian rock, surviving since creation. Come back in August when levels are low, and I will once more mark safe passage. I get to read too. Some of you may have heard, this is my favorite quote from Emerson, "Everything is made of one hidden stuff." If you think about that, it's really kind of neat. This poem is called Hidden Stuff. Just once I'd like to have a day to do nothing but watch hawks and treetop eagles. Stand by a river when winter melts and spring flexes her muscles. The Embarrass or Pokegama will do just fine. Feel the weight of frozen months rise with the boiling sap steam. My feet once more anchored to brown, soft ground. Soup stock where ancient elements swim. Hidden stuff of Emerson. Thank you.
This is called Not Drowning. Maybe a lot of kids growing up in this water area of 10,000 lakes have an experience like mine. I was born in another language, in my mother's tongue that flowed like the river around my childhood. I was shore to sapphire and stones and music of the accordions and tailgate parties and nighttime arguments. I write in the currents. Instead of a beginning, expect hidden sources, underground springs, and cold streams. Expect a brogue, a Finnish tongue. I fell in her silences, in the sound of falling water. There is a river between a girl and her mother, two tongues of long rivers. They rehearse the forces of reversals, harness an awkward, onward, outward neverness. I learned to swim by drowning. She was one way, and I another, but followed in her shadow and flow. Rivers talk in verse and lead to the mouth. I pour sentences into waves that rise into crests and break, roll like surf, grind down to syllables and vowels. I swallow mist. The river here and elsewhere runs through toxic waste and green organic matter, through the past into the future, all the same according to the river. Erosion and accretion, migration and migration. Now is the river, and now, and now, and now. This is where I wade, oblivious to the drop-off. Nothing stops here, and her, she bewilders, wilder for a moment, then idler, ice or vapor. In the riverbank, frogs sleep. As the ice breaks and sun makes mud, the river pours past awakenings, broken stems, old grass, roots, fallen limbs, new sprouts. The river erases, lifts the bottom to the top, sinks the surfaces around the bends and through channels down slopes in between over boulder and rock, over ledge and limitations, under this bridge and through that. River pushes everything aside back into the confluence. She travels through layers, through violence and its afterwash, silence and sibilance and distant acquaintance. Rivers lie and never lie, remain awake while sleeping. Rivers don't ask what matters or if it does. They're falling as they're falling, tangled and nonconforming with gaps and circuits and junctures. A birth in this world is a death in the other. A death in this world is a birth in the other. If you are a child bearing a mother or a mother bearing a child, there is a vibration, a tone, an echo, broken in a place where broken finds new form and new forms are broken. Where one ends, another begins, over or underground. What drives the river must be driven further. Some say words don't matter, not in short lines or longer. Many texts have ground into stones, into fine sand, and then the wind takes it farther. Rivers digress. They speak many languages. They are gospel. All possibility, muddy and clear. Every drop must merge and surge. Can surging not be poetry? The river is far-fetched, a lesson in ecstasy with opposing forces, apostasy, erotic urges. She was dancing while I was drowning. Currents plunge from stone and precipice, take the breath, hold oncoming dangers against desires. Rivers enter the graves of other rivers, fall from other births. I come from underwater. There was a ladder of light I had to climb. One joins instead of begins, finds another bar with higher and lower notes. Apprehensions, uncertainties, and fragments float, and I was saved. Rain falls and soil slides in, and the rivers wick into crevices and creep along concrete forms. There, but for the grace of fluid dynamics, rivers fill root capillaries, erode the bones, dampen the percussion, carrying all the light. They pulled me from the river. The air came back into my lungs. My mother, a cantata, opera, symphony with continuous finales, was gone, but still arriving. Thank you.
Hello, my name is David Cowarden, and I am an author and filmmaker from Duluth, Minnesota. And this piece is called Filling in the Blanks, Suicide in the St. Louis River. And before I read this piece, I want everybody to think about this, that 1 in 4 adults will experience a mental illness in any given year. So chances are you or somebody that you know has been affected by mental illness and likely has felt uncomfortable speaking about that. A lot of times, especially in Northern Minnesota, we can feel very guarded, and I think if there's one thing that the listeners can take from this is that it's okay to talk about these issues that are common but not commonly talked about. So again, this is called Filling in the Blanks, Suicide in the St. Louis River. I spend a lot of time thinking about rivers, cascading tributaries splitting through the bedrock of the North Shore awaken me a sense of timelessness. Spawning fish hurling their lithe bodies over rock ledges inspire in me a sense of purpose and motive. Every river bend, eddy, and seam of current communicates to me its own earthly message. But when I think about the St. Louis River, I think of my friend Ryan. I think of the many nights we spent fishing under the Oliver Train Bridge. I think of the smile on his face as he held the walleye up for my camera. I think of the trophy sturgeon he hooked that towed our canoe from riverbank to riverbank. I think of the heaviness of our laughter and joy. But more than anything, I think of how fragile and fleeting life can be. Ryan died by suicide in July of 2015. I wish I could elaborate more on that fact, but there are a lot of blank spaces in the narrative that will forever remain empty because Ryan isn't here to fill them in. How did he do it, I would ask myself, and why? One of the many struggles we face when we lose someone to suicide is the urge to fill in those blanks, to make sense of such a tragic event, but we can't, can we? I'm a documentary filmmaker in Minnesota. The summer Ryan died, I was completing a video series about mental illness stigma. After interviewing a number of people affected by mental illness, I thought I had a better grasp on the issue and a greater ability to recognize someone who was struggling. And then, on a Monday afternoon in July, I was scrolling through my Facebook feed when I saw Ryan's cousin announce that Ryan had died by suicide. And just like that, my heart fell deep within my chest, as I realized that even after producing a documentary about mental illness, I was completely blind to how close it was to me. Why didn't I see it? Why didn't he tell me he had depression? The answers to those questions will always remain blank spaces, curling over a campfire like a blue ribbon of smoke fading into darkness, shimmering like the roll of a rainbow trout before darting into obscurity to that deep pocket of black water. Those blank spaces are haunting. So instead, I think about the St. Louis River. I think about geese winging their way south, honking overhead as Ryan slipped on his new fingerless fishing gloves that kept him warm on crisp autumn nights. I think of the warm sun descending behind the hill and the vibrant colors reflected on the water like a painting. I think of all the quietness and peace in those moments, the simplicity. Slowly, and perhaps just as softly as Ryan ascended to the heavens, those memories begin to occupy the blank spaces.
You're listening to a special one-hour broadcast of One River, Many Stories, stories and poetry about the St. Louis River. We'll take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll have more stories and poetry read before a live audience at the University of Wisconsin in Superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. Good evening. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Shawamigan Bay Area and Duluth Superior is home to many talented writers. Tonight, we feature stories and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the One River, Many Stories project. This year, 8 writers were chosen by 3 judges to read their stories and poems about the St. Louis River. We now bring you their stories as told before a live audience on Wednesday, April 27th at UW Superior. Wisconsin Public Radio presents One River, Many Stories.
My name is Deanna Erickson. I live in Duluth. And I went on a hike down the Superior Hiking Trail a couple of years ago and crossed all these rivers. And I just started, I think about the lake all the time, and then I started seeing that they were the same thing. So this is a poem about that. And it's called Watershed Song. The blood of Lake Superior runs in veins. Under forests, reaches beyond the blue horizon and seeps deeper than what we know. The lake of unpredictable wind and iron ships, the famous outline on vacationers' t-shirts, on forearm tattoos, the lake to whom we pledge allegiance, the lake with whom we live, is limited only by topography and held only by gravity. The lake is pooling in snowmelt in my backyard this afternoon. She is roaring down northern canyons and spreading quietly into estuaries. She is flowing through rocks, through tailings piles, eroding her own indentation into sand and volcanic stone. Rivers as her arteries, each with a year-long heartbeat, high water, then low, rivers as her children, named Baptism, Nipigon, Caribou, Brule, Kaministiquia, Partridge, Savannah, St. Louis, children from whom there is no separation, rivers as gifts, as warmth, as shelter, as legacy. Rivers as both birth and death carried to her shore.
You can see why Deanna won the Bard's Chair at the St. David's Day reading. That's beautiful. This poem was inspired by a visit to my daughter and her family. Her husband was stationed at the St. Mary's Naval Base, which is just across the river from Jacksonville, Florida. And it's such a different ecosystem. It's called Back North. Leaving Georgia tidal basins, stagnant swamps where we struggled to breathe, we return to cascading bronze ribbons studded with crystal. Cloquet and whiteface scour their beds, shake out ferns, purify the air, and leave us breathless.
My name is Stephen Schramm, and I'm from Washburn, Wisconsin. And my piece is called St. Louis River Reflections. My first glimpse of the St. Louis River came in 1963 while on a family vacation. Dad and I shared a love of the Great Lakes as well as a keen interest in all cargo-carrying vessels. When we stopped to check out the Duluth Superior Harbor, we had fun identifying boats by color and smokestack logos. We were boat nerds, years before the term even existed. Little did I know, one day I'd be part of a team making decisions about this outstanding natural resource. My first job as a fisheries biologist started in 1976 with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Excited to have the St. Louis River as part of my new territory, I couldn't wait to get on the water. For years, upstream paper mill waste gave fish a bad taste. Consequently, anglers usually threw their catch back. Biologists called it an off flavor. Anglers were more blunt with their description. When the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District began treating domestic and industrial waste in 1978, water quality dramatically improved. Word about the improved fishery spread like wildfire. Winter-weary anglers flocked to the river for the spring opener. Within 2 years, the walleye fishery was well known throughout the Midwest. It was an exciting time to be working on the St. Louis River. Almost overnight, there was a healthy fish population which demanded scientific management, or the turnaround could become a victim of its own success. We needed to find out as much as possible about the fishery. Initially, we focused on identifying critical habitats for fish in the lower estuary. Management agencies were struggling to find a balance between economic development and resource protection. During the spring of 1978 and 1979, the Wisconsin DNR gathered a wealth of biological data on northern pike. Working in the harbor had its challenges. Our sampling gear weighed down the boat, and water threatened to swamp us, requiring sharp seamanship skills on days with rough seas and gusty winds. Plus, the large wake of a passing commercial vessel always received our full attention. In 1980, our focus switched to spawning walleyes upstream from the Highway 23 bridge at Fond du Lac. We used an electrofishing boat, which was fitted with cables that sent electric currents into the water. The electrical current drew fish toward the boat where they were netted. The spawning season allows biologists a narrow window to collect data when the greatest number of fish are concentrated in a relatively small area. While we caught and processed over 3,000 walleyes, one boat and crew just couldn't collect an adequate sample. I knew I had to develop an alternative plan. Unfortunately, I also knew I had to wait until the following spring. During that winter, I hired an extra crew so we could sample the spawning population using two boats. We also partnered with the Minnesota DNR, who would be collecting walleye spawn just below the Fond du Lac Dam. Between the two agencies, we hoped to collect enough data to develop a population estimate. When the spring of 1981 arrived, we enthusiastically headed to Fond du Lac. The crew in the electrofishing boat collected walleyes, transferred the fish to another boat for processing, then headed out to collect more. This pattern repeated itself all day for 18 days. By the end of the season, we handled over 6,000 walleyes. The St. Louis River became our office, lab, and lunchroom. Every day around noon, we tied the boats to shore, sat against a tree, and devoured sandwiches. We talked about current events and sports, but mostly we talked about fish, or just listened to the rush of water and the song of the red-winged blackbird. Even a cold, miserable, all-day rain produced only a bit of whining. The area was pretty much inaccessible except by boat. Consequently, we were alone with the river and the walleyes. 35 years later, it's still a great memory. Truth be told, I talked to the walleyes as I went about collecting biological data. Or sometimes I talked out loud, but mostly questions remained in my head. I wondered how old they were, where they came from, where they were going, what they ate for their last meal, and how it felt to be swimming in a clean river again. I continue this practice my entire career, and I'm happy to report not a single fish answered me. For the remainder of 1981, we searched for walleyes in the river and Lake Superior. Foggy weather often provided a challenge, forcing us to navigate by dead reckoning using a compass and watch. By the end of the year, our sample size had increased to over 7,200 fish. Valuable new information helped us answer some lingering questions. For example, These slow-growing walleyes were some of the oldest in the Great Lakes area. We called them geriatric walleyes. And while most stayed in western Lake Superior when not spawning, a few decided to travel. The farthest moving to Marquette, Michigan, about 370 water miles from Fond du Lac. Since we sampled the fishery a couple years after water quality improved, our data basically described a walleye population before any significant fishing mortality, providing a historical reference point for future biologists. While collecting data on fish currently living in the river, I began thinking about reestablishing lake sturgeon. These gentle giants are indigenous to Lake Superior and the St. Louis River, but disappeared from the river during the early 1900s. While habitat in the lower harbor had been drastically altered, their spawning area in the upper estuary remained relatively unchanged. So after several years of planning, the Wisconsin DNR released the first sturgeon in 1983. 2 years later, the Minnesota DNR joined us, and together the two agencies continued stocking. Because of slow growth, everyone knew it would be decades before mature fish might return to spawn. Recently, biologists found young sturgeon near Fond du Lac, indicating the stocked fish not only returned to the spawning area, they reproduced successfully. While this is wonderful news, we need to keep in mind it's just another step in a long process of rehabilitating a degraded river system and managing a long-lived species. Today, fresh faces, energetic organizations, and new technology combine to tackle different challenges. Community spirit is also just as vibrant now as it was in 1976. It's still an exciting time to be working on the St. Louis River.
St. Louis River. My words smell of rain and thunder. I draw them from headwaters in the north, from vapor and fluid and ice. My words are steeped in the peat bog and visited by owls. My syllables are fed by the underground springs in caverns of copper. My vowels rise from the roots of the pines, flow over and under consonants, seep through moss, stream through veins and culverts, fall over stones, pour through chains of lakes to spill and fall full of iron and ore into the great lake where everything stirs at the bottom, unseen, the bones and barrels and logs held in long sentences. I breathe in the mist. At the river's mouth, waves rise, break, and subside. Light bends in the depth, and sound changes its speed.
Wow, what an amazing evening of storytelling. Can we ask for one more round of applause, please? Thank you. So this concludes Wisconsin Public Radio's presentation of One River, Many Stories. And on behalf of the One River, Many Stories grant team, Paul Lundgren and John Hatcher, who are both with us this evening, as well as Chris Julin, Emily Havoc, and our project coordinator, Julie Boudreau, who's also here with us, thank you all for telling your stories about the St. Louis River. Thanks again to the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation for funding this project and the University of Minnesota Duluth Journalism Program. Thanks also goes out to our judges, UW-Superior Writing Professor Julie Gard, St. Louis River Alliance Project Coordinator Sarah Glessner, and WPR reporter Danielle Kading. Again, I'd also like to thank our writers this evening, Ashley Sullivan, Cliff Langley, Jan Cronister, David Cowardin, Deanna Erickson, Sheila Pekka, Mark Munger, Stephen Schramm, and all of those who submitted stories for this event. And of course, a final thanks to UW Superior for hosting tonight's reading, and engineer John Talcott for providing technical assistance. Again, I'm Jennifer Moore with the One River Many Stories Project. Thank you all so much for coming this evening. Good night.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online and read all the submissions we received as part of the One River Many Stories Project at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading. Hear Me Out returns next Monday evening on Wisconsin Public Radio. Until then, have a great rest of your week. If you leave